Slavery, The Facts, Part 3, by Robert Smythe. Many white people, particularly in Britain and the United States, campaigned against the slave trade and slavery. Some of them, probably those who were most egotistic and intent on self-publicity, have been elevated to sainthood. They are revered more than ever today when the religion of political correctness has an apparent need for saints. Unfortunately, even just a little research reveals the shortcomings of these so-called saints, some of which must be more than a little embarrassing to their present-day worshippers. Four abolitionists are particularly idolized today: William Wilberforce, Thomas Clarkson, Harriet Beecher Stowe, and John Brown. Abraham Lincoln is also revered as an abolitionist. However, as we saw in the last podcast, not only was he a racist, but he was quite prepared to tolerate slavery in order, if necessary, to preserve the Union, and the so-called Emancipation Proclamation did not apply to slaves in areas controlled by his own government. Just as today there are those who seem more concerned about the welfare of foreigners than their own people, the well-heeled anti-slavery campaigners of the late 18th and early 19th centuries showed little or no inclination to campaign against the heartless exploitation of the white working classes. Even the Times, in its obituary of Clarkson, says, referring to both Clarkson and Wilberforce, quote, "It becomes extremely difficult to repress a feeling of regret that the extraordinary abilities and perseverance applied by them to the relief of half-human savages, the natives of a distant continent, could have found in this our native land no objects of sympathy, no field for philanthropic endeavours. The horrors of the Middle Passage were to their imaginations more fearful than the horrors to which the white slaves of England were exposed." Close quote. The great majority of British people lived and worked in appalling conditions, with long hours, low wages, no job security, and no vote. The factory reformer and children's rights campaigner Richard Osler, in a letter to the Leeds Mercury, referred to the situation in Wilberforce's Yorkshire in the following terms. "Let the truth speak out. Appalling as the statements may appear, the fact is true. Thousands of our fellow creatures and fellow subjects, both male and female, the inhabitants of a Yorkshire town, Yorkshire, now represented in Parliament by the giant of anti-slavery principles, are at this very moment existing in a state of slavery more horrid than are the victims of that hellish system, colonial slavery. The very streets which receive the droppings of an anti-slavery society are every morning wet with the tears of innocent victims at the accursed shrine of avarice, who are compelled not by the cartwhip of the negro slave driver, but by the dread of the equally appalling thong or strap of the overlooker, to hasten, half-dressed, but not half-fed, to those magazines of British infantile slavery, the worsted mills in the town and neighbourhood of Bradford. Thousands of little children, both male and female, but principally female, from 7 to 14 years, are daily compelled to labour from 6 o'clock in the morning to 7 in the evening, with only... Britons blush while you read it, with only 30 minutes allowed for eating and recreation." Close quote. Eventually, the Factory Act of 1833 was passed. It only prohibited the employment of children under the age of 9 in factories and mills, but even this did not apply to silk factories or mines. In 1842, 9 years after the abolition of black slavery in the British Empire, the Children's Employment Commission, in its inquiry into coal mines, found, among other terrible practices, that children from the age of 6 years upwards were employed in pushing and dragging coal wagons underground in England. that there were instances in which children as young as 4 were taken to work in the mines, that the hours of work for children and young people were rarely less than 11 hours a day, more often 12, sometimes 13, and in one area 14 or more. In some districts, working children remain in solitude and darkness during their whole time in the pit, many of them never seeing the light of day in winter, except on their non-work days. As a result, the Coal Mines Regulation Act of 1842 prohibited the employment of girls and young women in the mines. The employment of boys was also prohibited, but only if they were 9 years old or younger. Thus, Parliament, still basking in the abolition of black slavery, was still content to see 10-year-old boys working in the mines. Wilberforce was the most famous British abolitionist, and extremely rich, with inherited wealth. In 1779, he was elected Member of Parliament for Hull, a victory obtained by bribing the voters in the days before the secret ballot, and when only a privileged minority had the vote. According to his biography, written by his own son, the election cost him between £8,000 and £9,000, the equivalent of over £1 million in the year 2007. In 1784, he was elected to the county seat of Yorkshire, home of Ousler's dreaded Worsted Mills. Later, he apparently found it too burdensome to actually represent a significant number of people, and in 1812 he became MP for the pocket borough of Bramber in Sussex. This constituency had just 35 houses and 20 voters, all in the pocket of his wife's cousin, Lord Calthorpe. Not surprisingly, Wilberforce was elected unopposed. Wilberforce had been a Member of Parliament for some 8 years before latching onto the slave trade issue at the prompting of Thomas Clarkson. Yet he must have been aware of the horrors of the trade long before, as others had been campaigning for many years, including David Hartley, whom he unseated at Hull through his greater money power. Further, he could hardly have missed the publicity in 1783 concerning the slave ship Zong, where over 100 slaves were deliberately thrown overboard in an unsuccessful insurance scam. While campaigning for abolition, Wilberforce also helped establish the Sierra Leone Company, becoming one of its first directors. The main aim of this company was to send free blacks to its colony in West Africa. The commercial side of the company soon failed, but not before hundreds of blacks had been settled in Sierra Leone, and in the 19th century it became the place where the British Royal Navy dumped freed slaves. Wilberforce, therefore, like Lincoln, was in favour of sending the blacks back to Africa. Slavery was not Wilberforce's only interest. He actively opposed campaigns for political and social reform in Britain, supporting the suspension of habeas corpus in 1794 to allow internment without trial of political dissidents. He also backed the 1795 Act against seditious meetings and assemblies, and other legislation, the so-called gagging bills, that enabled the government to prevent meetings of such dangerous organisations as the Literary Society of Manchester and the Academical Society of Oxford. Publishers, sellers, editors and writers were prosecuted, including the publishers and sellers of Thomas Paine's epic book, The Rights of Man. At the instigation of Wilberforce, Parliament passed the Combination Acts of 1799 and 1800, which effectively outlawed trade unions, providing for imprisonment and even hard labour for their contravention. As writers of a classic work on the labouring classes wrote, Wilberforce's zeal for Negro liberty was only equalled by his enthusiasm for repressing insubordination in white workers. In the midst of poverty and distress caused by the slump in after the defeat of Napoleon, Wilberforce distinguished himself by supporting the new Corn Laws that artificially raised the price of bread for the benefit of landowners, while labourers had no means of seeking higher wages or even stopping any reduction in wages. As a result, Wilberforce required the protection of a squad of soldiers outside his Kensington mansion. As protests and agitation for one man and one vote increased, Wilberforce became a member of a secret parliamentary committee in 1817 to consider suppression of popular dissent. He approved the suspension of habeas corpus once again, and the notorious Six Acts, which restricted freedom of the press and freedom of assembly. He was also interested in religion, telling a friend in 1813 that he had decided against granting Roman Catholics eligibility for all civil offices. In 1790, he had voted against the repeal of the Test and Corporation Acts that barred Catholics and other dissenters from public office. Continually campaigning to foist Christianity on the people of India, he was instrumental in making the renewal of the East India Company's charter in 1813 dependent on the promotion of his religion, to the detriment of indigenous traditions. In this regard, his biographer states that, quote, "he set about the work with an energy and resolution which had never been exceeded, even when, in the vigour of his early youth, he fought the abolition battle." Close quote. Another of his great campaigns was to stamp out blasphemous and immoral behaviour, attacking vices of the lower orders, but ignoring the more licentious activities of the rich. He formed the Proclamation Society, whose successes included the imprisonment of the impoverished printer Thomas Williams in the notorious Cold Bath Fields prison for the offence of publishing cheap copies of Thomas Paine's The Age of Reason. Needless to say, in his younger days, Wilberforce had patronised several fashionable social and gambling clubs in London, on one occasion losing £100, the equivalent of £10,000 in 2007, at the Faro table. Possibly, as a result of his lifestyle, in 1788 he suffered what his son called a mysterious illness, which caused the decay of all vital functions. His eventual recovery was attributed to opium, to which he apparently became addicted for the rest of his life. The illness, however, meant that he was absent during the passage through Parliament of the Dolben Bill, which sought to improve the conditions of slaves on the Middle Passage. Wilberforce seems to have had a rather patronising attitude to fellow countrymen who were not born with silver spoons in their mouths. Thus, in his diary on the 8th of July, 1798, he casually writes, "I talked to several common people." While urging imprisonment without trial for political dissidents in the House of Commons in 1817, he referred to the need to isolate them from the lower orders, that valuable portion of the community whose labour was so essential to the social system under which we live. It may also be noted that Wilberforce referred to Clarkson and his brother as white Negroes. This patronising attitude to the poor also showed up in Wilberforce's charitable activities. He and his fellow evangelicals believed that charity, rather than social and political reform, was a way to deal with poverty and perhaps ease their own consciences. As one distinguished historian of the period wrote, however, in relation to the situation in 1819, quote, "Proud and independent Englishmen who, through no fault of their own, had seen their livelihood destroyed, their savings expended, their homes sold up, did not take kindly to the cold, patronising charity which was bestowed upon them by the distant rich to some soup kitchens, mendacity societies, workhouses, and the rates in aid of wages, which condemned their children to exile and slavery, and themselves to a detested surveillance. Even the good works of the untiring evangelicals only embittered them all the more. It was at this time that the man who had abolished the slave trade became known to his poorer countrymen as Mr. Cantwell. Close quote. Crocodile tears and charity were not going to create work for the unemployed or improve conditions in factories and mines, but they did deflect attention away from the need for real reform and probably helped to postpone it for decades.
Tune in to Radio Stormer on thedailystormer.com.
Thomas Clarkson is generally regarded as the leading British abolitionist after Wilberforce. He was one of the founders of the Committee for the Abolition of the African Slave Trade in 1787, a skilled propagandist who devoted his whole life to the slavery issue, travelling widely to collect evidence and showing no mean amount of courage in confronting seamen and others connected with the slave trade. His most lasting contribution to the cause was probably the well-known sketch of slaves crammed together on a ship like sardines, which he and his committee produced and publicised. The sketch is almost invariably used today whenever slavery is mentioned, and it still incites great emotional responses that spill over into debate about contemporary racial issues. Thus, the sketch appears in the British government's glossy, free 30-page booklet, issued purportedly to commemorate the bicentenary of the repeal of the Slave Trade Act. Interestingly, however, part of the sketch showing two large blank spaces in between all the people, or just around the outside, has been omitted. The sketch represents the slave ship, Brooks, showing how the legally permitted maximum number of slaves might be accommodated on the ship. As an art correspondent of a national newspaper has recently noted, it wasn't, strictly speaking, a documentary record of the facts. It was a hypothetical projection. In fact, a more accurate representation of slave ship conditions is probably illustrated in the Rugendas painting, The Hold of a Slave Ship, from 1827. Rugendas was himself a campaigner against the slave trade, and his picture does show that conditions were horrific, although most of the slaves are shown either sitting or standing, and one is actually lying on a hammock. Like Wilberforce, Clarkson was also closely involved with the Sierra Leone Company, which initially resettled free slaves from Canada. He had great hopes for the fashionable repatriation project, writing rather patronisingly that schools, places of worship, agriculture, and the habits of civilised life were established. Sierra Leone, therefore, now presents itself as the medium of civilization for Africa. It is worth all the treasure which has been lost in supporting it. There is a metropolis consisting of some hundreds of persons from which may issue the seeds of reformation to this injured continent, and which, when sown, may be expected to grow into fruit without interruption. The directors of the Sierra Leone Company, who included Thomas Clarkson, Wilberforce, Granville Sharp, and other leading abolitionists, despite their pious pretensions, refused to allow the settlers to own land freehold. Knowing how tenants were being treated in the Highland clearances, the settlers revolted in 1799. Meanwhile, the campaign against the slave trade seemed to be making headway with the support of Prime Minister William Pitt, who considered that the trade was more beneficial to the highly efficient sugar plantations on the French island of Saint-Domingue, later Haiti, than to British interests. Such support strangely faded, however, when Britain was afforded the opportunity to take over Saint-Domingue, and by 1794 the campaign ground to a virtual halt. Clarkson, who by this time had spent most of his own money, decided, for health reasons, to remove himself from the campaign. Wilberforce arranged financial support for him, even though there had been an acrimonious dispute between the two when Wilberforce refused to use his influence to get Clarkson's brother a promotion in the Navy. Clarkson rejoined the fray 9 years later to share the victory of Wilberforce and his colleagues in 1807, when changing political and economic developments led to abolition. Years later, in 1838, after Wilberforce's death, a pathetic dispute broke out between his sons and Clarkson. His sons, in their initial biography of their father, claimed that Wilberforce was campaigning against the slave trade before Clarkson. In fact, Clarkson was first, as Wilberforce himself stated at a meeting in 1830, mentioned in the Times. However, Clarkson's disproportionate response in Strictures on a Life of William Wilberforce unhappily did not show him up at his best, and nor did Clarkson's endorsement of workhouses. Like other abolitionists, Clarkson did not seem too concerned about the dreadful living and working conditions of many of his own white countrymen. In 1838, a new workhouse was named after him in his hometown of Wisbeach, presumably with his approval, as he was living in the town at the time. In Wisbeach today, there is a statue of Clarkson, and in its museum, at the time of writing anyway, there is an exhibit commemorating the workhouse. Workhouses, like the one at Wisbeach, were established under the Poor Law Amendment Act, enacted in 1834, 1 year after the abolition of black slavery. These dreadful Dickensian institutions were deliberately designed to degrade, humiliate, and punish the poor. They endeavoured to make the status of the able-bodied pauper less desirable than the position of the worst-paid labourer. Before 1842, married couples, whatever their age, were separated in and had no right to see their own children in the same workhouse. The poor referred to workhouses as the new Bastilles.
You're listening to Radio Stormer on thedailystormer.com.
Harriet Beecher Stowe's highly emotional, heart-rending book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, was published in 1852 and quickly became a bestseller on both sides of the Atlantic. It incited much hatred and hand-wringing in the North, but the realism of its portrayal of plantation slavery has been widely questioned, and not just in the Confederate States. Mrs. Stowe lived in the North, and her only experience of life in a slave state before the Civil War came from a weekend visit to Kentucky, which just happened to be one of those slave states that stayed in the Union and supported the North when war came. In Britain, Uncle Tom's Cabin created a lot of interest and sympathy for the American slaves, particularly among many society ladies, perhaps helping to avert their eyes from the conditions of their working and dispossessed white countrymen. Prominent among these ladies was the Duchess of Sutherland, who was the prime mover in organising a petition against slavery in America, though not apparently in Brazil, Africa, or the Middle East. The petition was presented to Mrs. Stowe, who visited Britain shortly afterwards. When Mrs. Stowe came to Britain again in 1856, she was greeted like an old friend by the Duchess, who provided hospitality for the novelist at the Sutherland's palatial mansion at Dunrobin in Scotland. During her stay at Dunrobin, Mrs. Stowe wrote another book entitled Sunny Memories, which sought to whitewash the dreadful Highland clearances that the Sutherland dynasty had been engaged in for half a century, together with other landowners, in order to make room for sheep. The clearances involved the pitiless eviction of crofters and their families from home and land occupied traditionally by them for centuries. After eviction, the homes were burnt or otherwise destroyed to prevent reoccupation, and the victims were moved to marginal land on the coast or forced to emigrate. The whole process was usually conducted with the utmost ruthlessness and sometimes with cruelty, with women and children, elderly and the sick, being bodily removed from their own homes and dumped in the open in all weathers. On the Sutherland estates alone, 10,000 people had been dispossessed and replaced by 40 sheep farmers and their flocks from the Scottish lowlands and from England. Sheep were proving to be far more profitable than people. Mrs. Stowe, however, spent most of her time in the luxurious surroundings of Dunrobin Castle and did not see, and or did not want to see, the ruins of the crofts or the suffering of the dispossessed. Her views coincided with those of the evicting landowners and their agents. Any criticisms of the Sutherlands that did come to her attention were dismissed as slanders or ridiculous stories. In fact, she summed up the clearances as an almost sublime instance of the benevolent employment of superior wealth and power in shortening the struggles of advancing civilization. It is no wonder, perhaps, that her admirers rarely, if ever, refer to sunny memories. Donald MacLeod, who lived and worked as a mason in the Highlands for many years during the clearances, wrote a reply to Mrs. Stowe entitled Gloomy Memories. Referring to the sources for her book on the clearances, he wrote, quote, "If you took the information and evidence upon which you founded your Uncle Tom's cabin from such unreliable sources, who can believe just one-tenth of your novel? I cannot." Close quote. John Preble describes her as a simple, impressionable woman, an amateur reporter who did not know how or where to find the truth. She could believe no evil of a woman who so admired Uncle Tom and so passionately supported the abolition of slavery. After the Civil War, Mrs. Stowe visited the former Confederate States for the first time, going south in the wake of the victorious Union armies with other carpetbaggers. She bought an estate in sunny Florida, presumably at a knockdown price.
You're listening to Radio Stormer on thedailystormer.com.
John Brown is still regarded as a hero who tried to liberate slaves by force in the years before the American Civil War, when in actuality, after a lifetime of failure culminating in bankruptcy, he found solace as a terrorist and cold-blooded killer on behalf of the up-and-coming abolitionist cause that was to provide him with money and fame. In 1855, he moved to Kansas Territory to join some of his sons who had settled there and got involved in the developing civil strife between pro- and anti-slavery factions. The issue was whether Kansas, when it became a state, should be slave or free. At the time, the Kansas legislature had a pro-slavery majority, but abolitionists were being encouraged to settle there to outvote them. One organization, the New England Emigrant Aid Company, was selling bonds to fund anti-slavery settlers. At the same time, pro-slavery settlers were coming in from neighboring Missouri, and it is interesting to note that these were referred to as border ruffians, whereas the anti-slavers were called free soilers. Just as in the southern slave states, only about 5% of whites owned slaves, very few of the pro-slavery settlers in Kansas would have been slave owners, but they may have perceived that the possibility of investment in the new state would be greater if slavery was allowed. In any event, here was an issue that Brown could exploit. The tinderbox of Kansas was set alight by Brown when he led a brutal armed gang, including four of his own sons and two other fanatics, into the peaceful Pottawatomie Valley one night in May 1856, slaughtering at least five men and boys. Every effort has been made since to excuse, obscure, gloss over, or sweep under the carpet the savagery that took place that night. But as a review in the New York Times concluded decades later in referring to the atrocity, quote, "As the evidence now for the first time fully assembled proves, beyond any question, the men whom he and his followers killed were not given the slightest opportunity to defend themselves, but were led from their homes and mercilessly cut down." Close quote. All the victims were apparently known for their pro-slavery position, but none of them was a slave owner, and one of them, Alan Wilkinson, was an elected member of the Kansas legislature. There are still varying accounts of the horrors of that night, but there is general agreement that the five victims were killed in cold blood with broadswords. Some accounts referring to the mutilation of bodies. One account, however, in the specialist magazine Real West, claims that next morning, 20 men, women, and children lay mangled hideously in death in Pottawatomie Valley. The same account does not mince words, accusing Brown of being not only a failure in normal life, but a fraudster and an embezzler of church funds, who is known on the prairies of Kansas as the West's bloodiest killer. The massacre is usually only mentioned briefly, if at all, by media commentators. When it is mentioned, the excuse is sometimes put forward that it was a revenge for disorders in the Kansas town of Lawrence a few days before, when a pro-slavery mob destroyed a hotel and house belonging to the New England Emigrant Aid Company and two newspaper offices. Nevertheless, no one was killed or even injured during this mayhem, and there seems to be no suggestion that Brown's victims were involved. After the massacre at Pottawatomie, however, a period of guerrilla warfare, engaged in by both sides, ensued, in which dozens of people were killed, giving rise to the name of Bleeding Kansas. Brown evaded arrest, but 2 years later raided a settlement in Missouri, and also an event rarely mentioned. One account, however, says that one settler was killed in the raid, and 11 black slaves liberated and taken to Canada. According to another account, 15 people were murdered, and 5 of the free blacks deserted Brown before they even reached Kansas, and the others were abandoned to fend for themselves. The exploit for which Brown is generally known, giving him at last the publicity he seemed to crave for, was the raid on the federal arsenal and armory at Harper's Ferry in Virginia, the second biggest arsenal in the USA. After months of planning and fundraising, Brown launched his Army of Liberation on Harper's Ferry in October 1859, with the aim of seizing tens of thousands of weapons and handing them out to all the slaves he expected to flock to his army. Brown and 22 men, or 18 or 19 in some accounts, included 5 blacks, and seized the arsenal and armory and held the town and its 3,000 inhabitants for 12 hours. Guards were posted at bridges, telegraph wires were cut, prominent citizens and about 35 workers from the ordnance plant were held as hostages. Citizens resisting arrest and questioning were fired upon. Brown thought that the slaves would rally to him. He boasted to Colonel Washington, a relative of America's first president, taken captive at his plantation some 5 miles away, that by noon there will be 2,500 men with us, ready armed. However, no slaves actually rallied to Brown, including the ones liberated at Colonel Washington's plantation. Angry local people besieged the armory and militia when they realized what was happening, and they were later joined by federal troops. Marines stormed in and took the place in 3 minutes after Brown had refused to surrender. The whole adventure was all over in less than 2 days, and would have been over even quicker if the Marines had not been held back during the night for fear of injuring the hostages. 10 of Brown's gang were killed, including 2 of his sons and 2 blacks, together with 5 men on the other side. Most accounts are rather coy concerning the people killed by the Brown gang, but it is generally acknowledged that the first casualty was a free black, Shepherd Haywood, who was the respected baggage master at the town's railway station. He was mortally wounded, shot in the back, while fleeing from the terrorists guarding the Potomac Bridge. 1 Marine was killed in the storming of Brown's final refuge. 3 more civilians were killed, but the exact circumstances of their deaths are not clear in most accounts, even if the deaths are mentioned at all. However, 1 online encyclopedia offers us an explanation. Quote, although Brown cut telegraph lines in order to avoid detection and to facilitate later escape, he made the mistake of detaining a train for 5 hours. The next day, when the train reached Baltimore, the authorities in Washington were alerted, and on the 17th of October, local militia surrounded the arsenal, cutting off the escape routes. In retaliation, Brown's men shot 3 of the town's citizens and moved 9 prisoners to the engine house. Close quote. The escapade was a complete fiasco, ending in the deaths of 15 people. Brown and some surviving members of his gang were tried, found guilty of treason and first-degree murder, and were hanged. But John Brown's soul goes marching on in the ranks of the politically correct today.
You're tuned in to Radio Stormer on thedailystormer.com.
In 2007, coinciding with the bicentenary of the British abolition of the black slave trade, the International Slavery Museum was opened in Liverpool, which was Britain's biggest slave trading port from the mid-18th century, when the trade was at its height. Before 1830, London was the main slaving port, and according to a British government information booklet, profits from the trade funded much of the city's industrial and financial success. The comments on London seem questionable in light of Liverpool's experience. In 1792, Liverpool had 131 sailings, compared with 42 for Bristol and 22 for London. But nevertheless, according to the BBC website, the slave trade was not essential to Liverpool. Even at its height, less than 10% of outbound shipping was heading for Africa. Both Wilberforce and Thomas Clarkson mentioned the true effect of the slave trade on Liverpool. They were able to give contemporary assessments in light of the massive amount of evidence that they had collected for their abolition campaign. During one great debate in Parliament on the trade in 1791, Wilberforce showed that British ports were in no way dependent on the slave trade. And regarding Liverpool, Wilberforce said, quote, long might she be rich and flourishing, provided it was by fair and honest gains, but it was not by this detestable traffic that she had risen to her present opulence, and that not only because it composed but a 30th part of her export trade, but also because it was a mere lottery, profitable indeed to some individuals, but a losing trade on the whole. Close quote. It was not by this detestable traffic that she had risen to her present opulence. The same could surely have been said for the other ports, including London, which were less successful in the slave trade than Liverpool. Clarkson, during his on-the-spot inquiries in Liverpool, came across records of dock duties in the port. These showed that in 1772, when 100 vessels sailed out of Liverpool for Africa, the dock duties amounted to £4,552, and in 1779, when, as a result of the War of American Independence, only 11 ships were Africa-bound, the duties amounted to £4,957. This led Clarkson to two conclusions. The first was that the opulence of Liverpool, as far as the entry of vessels into its ports and the dock duties arising from thence were concerned, was not indebted to the slave trade, for these duties were highest when it had only 11 ships in that employ. The second was that there had been almost a practical experiment with respect to the abolition of it, for the vessels in it had been gradually reduced from 100 to 11, and yet the West Indians had not complained of their ruin, nor had the merchants or manufacturers suffered, nor had Liverpool been affected by the change. The bicentenary of Britain's abolition of the slave trade has led to an orgy of misinformation. However, the basic facts are these. Slavery has existed throughout thousands of years of recorded history. The transatlantic slave trade lasted for a few hundred years, for far less time than the trans-Saharan and the Barbary slave trades. The conditions of passage for transatlantic slaves were undoubtedly harsh, but they were also harsh for many other migrants of that era, especially so, perhaps, where their passages had been prepaid. The American Civil War was not fought to free the slaves. Five slave states fought with the North against the South. Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation in 1863 only freed the slaves in the South. It did not free the slaves in those slave states that supported the North. Very few white people in the American South, or indeed elsewhere, were slave owners or traders. There were thousands of black owners of slaves in America, as well as many more in Africa. Many white people campaigned tirelessly for the abolition of black slavery, but there seems to be no record at all of any campaign by any other races to free the white slaves of the North Africans. It should be remembered that during the era of the transatlantic slave trade, the great majority of white people were living and working in absolutely appalling conditions, as bad or worse than those endured by the slaves, and they had no vote or say in the running of their country's affairs. They and their descendants certainly cannot be held responsible in any way whatsoever for the evils of slavery.